Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
New U.S. sanctions on Iran took effect today, 6 months after President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the international nuclear deal.
The sanctions target Iran's shipping, financial, and energy sectors, all key to the country's already struggling economy.
The bombs, which the FBI referred to as improvised explosive devices, were sent to the FBI's bomb laboratory in Quantico, Virginia.
We're in Mexico again tonight as thousands of migrants try to find a faster way to the U.S. border. The White House says it's now getting help from the Mexican
making news out of Pittsburgh. A man accused in the shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh is pleading not guilty, and he also wants a jury trial because he's facing a 44 counts.
In the final seconds before the Boeing 737 MAX crashed into the water, it was traveling at more than 500 kilometers an hour. All 189 people on board were killed.
You've now entered the House of Mystery.
Crime, conspiracy, history, and science.
With your hosts, Hal Warren, Mike Brown,
Julie Sav, Michael Butterfield,
Dr. Joseph Usinski, and Michael Hawley.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Here's Johnny.
Well, welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren at the controls, and our co-host today is David Martinos. I'm cutting out three names. I'm only doing two.
That's fine. That works.
You know, serial killers have three names, not radio hosts. Come on.
You're outing me.
Yeah, well, we've been doing that a lot this week, it sounds like.
I know, right?
Boy, I don't even know what's going on. it must be that Bill Gates shot that I've got. Now I'm, it's taking control.
He's controlling you from afar.
Yeah, and he's following me around. He couldn't do that on my phone, but. Speaking of crimes and crime fiction and true crime, all that stuff, we've got a great author here. We've got W.A. Winter on the line. Thank you for being here.
Nice to be here, Alan. I appreciate your call. Incidentally, my fiction is written under the name W. A. Winter. My real name is William Swanson, and those of you who are interested in true crime will find my books under William Swanson. I just wanted to differentiate between the fiction and nonfiction. Plus, I kind of get a kick out of having a pen name, so truth be told.
I was going to say, why do you do that then? Why did you separate it not only with the types of books, but use a pen name for fiction?
Well, because I've been a journalist for more than 50 years, and I've always been, and I write a lot of feature stuff, long-form feature stuff, and I've always been sensitive to people thinking that I'm making things up, that I'm fictionalizing the facts. And so, you know, just to further separate in people's minds, to the extent they're thinking about it, between my fiction and nonfiction, it seemed appropriate to go with a pen name for the fiction.
Yeah, you know, I thought about that myself, because I've done all true crime, and I've never done a fiction. But I'm also scared to write fiction, so I haven't gone that way. But I always thought that I'd use a different name.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of one of those things.
Well, I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one who does that. I mean, other people do that, and it. I think there is a good reason to do that. There's nothing worse for a journalist than to have someone suggest that he's making things up or that he's coloring things for the sake of a good story.
But that's something you're going to always fight, don't you think? It's something I'm always seeing. Is someone that doesn't like what you write. That seems to be the trend, especially these last 10 years, is to attack the person that's writing, you know, the journalist, and saying, well, obviously that's bought and paid for, or you know, what he thinks.
Yeah.
You know, it's better to put you down than to actually talk about the facts.
I think that happens a lot.
Hmm. Well, what made you go from true crime and being a journalist and doing kind of a fact-based law enforcement and that sort of writing, and then go into doing fiction?
Well, I've always been a reader. I've always enjoyed stories, loved narrative. And as a kid, I would read both of the Minneapolis, like most cities, had two newspapers in those days, and I would read both of them every day. And I was particularly interested by the crime stories. The fictional ones, Dick Tracy, I loved the Dick Tracy comic strip. But I was always really interested in some of these stories, such as the ones I've written about, that created a stir and created a narrative that went on and on for months and then sometimes years. To me, that was almost like reading a good novel. I mean, it was almost Dickensian, some of these stories that I was reading serialized in the paper. And of course, Dickens wrote, he serialized his stories too, so there's nothing new about that. But there was just that, I was just intrigued by the storytelling aspect, and it seemed as though crime stories and stories involving police and the courts offered all kinds of dramatic possibilities and some really fascinating characters, many of whom I got to know as a journalist, the real ones, and many of whom I've had the pleasure of creating in my fiction, some based on real people and some just popping out of the ether as I've needed them. It's a kind of a remarkable process, actually, but that's a different story.
Hmm. Well, that is interesting, but I guess with fiction too, you can always decide how it's going to end. You can make things happen, and you can give answers. I know in my last true crime book, one of the reviewers just from a paper just sent me some questions, and I almost thought, well, these are silly questions actually, because it was like, well, why did this person do that, and why did this, you know, and mm-hmm. a lot of those things. And it's like, well, I'm not writing fiction. I can only tell you what they did. I could try and figure out why they did it. But, you know, other than that, it's speculation type thing. It was, but in fiction, you can actually give those answers.
Well, you can, yes, you can give those answers. And I've never been wild about fiction that has neat endings, you know, the old bogus word closure that I hate and I don't think applies to most crime scenes, crime stories, despite what people say. I think with my latest book, for instance, or my this particular novel, The Secret Lives of Dentists, there's a lot of uncertainty at the end. Regarding the guilt or innocence of this doctor, Rose, this dentist that I feature in here. There are plenty of other persons of interest in this book, and it's fun to hear people who have read this kind of speculate in front of me. Well, I think it was the driver, or I can't, you know, I think it was the reporter. I'm saying, no, it's not the reporter, you know, but it's you don't really know. You don't really know. And I like that in books. I like having it open-ended on the end. I mean, I think there's certainly enough information to draw conclusions, and I think readers will do that and do that. But even I was just talking about a nonfiction book I published about eight, nine years ago called Stolen from the Garden, which is about what at the time was the largest kidnapping for ransom in FBI history. Is $1 million ransom that was coerced out of a wealthy couple here in the Twin Cities back in 1972. And two men were eventually, after a long manhunt and investigation, were eventually tried, but they were ultimately acquitted. And only a couple of thousand dollars of the $1 million ransom was ever recovered. So it's also been called the most successful kidnapping in American history, and it just might be that. And I speculate at the end as to who it might be. I don't believe it was the two guys who were acquitted. That just doesn't make sense to me for a lot of reasons. But those books are, to me, are fascinating because they keep the reader wondering, and if it's powerful enough, maybe keep that reader awake at night.
Now, coming from a nonfiction and journalistic background, did you find it natural to write fiction, or did you find it a difficult transition?
No, I didn't find it difficult at all. That's a good question, but I've not only been reading all my life, I've been making up stories all my life. It's just that I put most of my emphasis on journalism until a couple of years ago. I would make up stories as a kid involving my electric train set and the little town I built around that train set. And I had good guys and bad guys. I didn't have sex in it yet, but you know, I was only 6 years old. That would have to wait a little bit. But you know, there was drama. There was drama, I loved making up stories. I liked reading stories, and I liked making them up, too. So that part wasn't difficult. And the research that even a novel requires, or at least my novels require, you know, I'm a skillful researcher. I've been doing it for a long time as a journalist. And so, you know, the information, the data you need not to provide documentary proof of something you're writing about, but to provide some verisimilitude so the reader will at least feel, oh yeah, I can see that happening. And to make the connections, I'm very, very interested in bringing Minneapolis, from the time I grew up in it, to life. Sometimes with references to real places, but at least to suggest a spirit and a language and the tensions derived from or evolving from cultural and ethnic differences, religious differences, and all of that. That interests me a lot, and so I do that kind of research. I do that kind of thought. But no, I've had no difficulty moving between them. Maybe that's another good reason to have a pen name, so I don't get too confused.
You know what? I think it's important because I find journalists or people that were actually in the field writing news stories know what it takes to actually go out and find what they need, like to do the research. A lot of people that don't have that experience tend to do everything. There's no primary source in their work. It's all secondary through the internet, which is, you know, fine for just talking, but not actually reporting. And I see that as a big problem nowadays. People tend to shy away from any sort of real established media, thinking that it's all, you know, whatever, conspiracy or fake news or whatever. But there's nothing like being a journalist living in a city, and an event happens and you go out and you talk to the people, you see them, you see the place, you know the events, and you can write about it like nobody else can, just over the internet. So I think that's important.
I think so too. And I've written a lot of magazine stories. As they say, I was a long form journalist for many years, and so I really got to know a lot of cops and a lot of prosecutors and a lot of defense attorneys. And you kind of learn how they talk and how they think, and all of that, I think, just makes a much richer. Can you hear my dog? A much richer and personality in your fiction. You know, there's just enough of the real thing, as you say, so the reader can make that connection between the fictional character and maybe a cop that he's known. You know, the defense attorney that he's dealt with over the years. So. Yeah, I think it's all connected. And when I was a journalist, when I was writing magazine stories, more than one person said, "Well, Bill's a novelist pretending to be a journalist," or maybe it was, "He's a journalist pretending to be a novelist." It was one of the two, because my long form stories, I tried to always make very novelistic or cinematic, if we want to jump genres here, you know, something that you could see and hear and try to feel. I didn't always succeed, but I sure tried at it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So when you talk about the setting, you know, the scene, the place where it's written, are you writing the location as a character as well?
I don't follow you there, Alan.
Well, because when you talk about a location, like you go to sites in Minneapolis and stuff, and that, do you include that in your fiction? Do you make kind of the location very important, like a character?
Well, I think it's important. It's important for me to place myself in those settings. I have a big, you know, 4x6 foot. It's not that big, but it's big. Street map of Minneapolis circa 1950. And it's on the wall behind me here. And I'm always referring to it. Now is Lyndale east or west of Nicollet? You know, just things like that would be embarrassing, among other things, if I got it wrong. But also just to kind of juice me up and think, yeah, I can see that. I've lived here. I know that place. I know exactly where it is. Where the body is found in this poor young woman's body in The Secret Lives of Dennis is on a former trolley track right of way that's just a couple blocks from where I've been living now for the past 45 years with my family. And I walk the aforementioned dog along that former trolley track all the time, and I can't help but walk down that stretch without thinking, well, this is where Teresa's body was found. I can see I almost have to lift my feet so I don't trip over it. I mean, it becomes so vivid and so real, in part because I know the location. I know the shadows, and I know the lights from the few street lamps that are in the area. I know all that, and it just kind of becomes embedded in me. And then as I write, I hope it's vivid on the page as well.
Well, so who is Teresa for you? Who is that character? Where does she come from?
Well, that's an interesting story, and unfortunately, I can't tell it in whole because I would probably get in a lot of trouble here. But most of the characters in this book, including Teresa, are at least inspired by real people, including a lot of people that I've known over the years, and just aspects of it. That's the thing. You don't have to recreate this person. You don't have to redraw the biography of this individual. It might just be a smile, or it might just be a tone of voice or an expression that he or she uses that in your mind, in the writer's mind, really, really creates the character. And names are extremely important to me. And the funny thing about that is I never puzzle over a name. It's one of the magics of writing fiction. The name comes to me, and I don't know where the hell it comes from. Most of the time, the names just pop out as I'm writing. And again, I don't know how it happens, and I don't want to overthink it. But Teresa, I call her Terry. She's not a real person, but she is inspired. She's inspired by a historical person who was, in fact, a young woman murdered by her dentist. In real life, it's a much more cut and dried case than it is in my fiction. But she's not the character. She's the character only in form only. My Teresa is entirely a creation of my imagination based on a couple of recollections of a young woman who I knew a long time ago. And that's probably true with a lot of my characters. I've got a cop, a detective, who's kind of a minor character, but I love the guy. Well, he's in my mind, he's a dead ringer for a kid I grew up with back in the old neighborhood, you know, 50-plus years ago. And I give him the same last name that he had then, and the same glossy pompadour that he wore in the 50s. But he is my guy. The real guy was not a cop, and this guy is, and that's the only connection is the last name and this mental recollection I have of him. I haven't seen this guy for a long, long time, and I hope he reads the book and recognizes himself. That would be fun. I think.
You never know, right?
I hope, yeah.
Whenever you have a bad character, a character that's a killer, or a character that's kind of evil, how do you come up with that character? Is that from someone you've seen or someone you've met? Just is that inspired as well?
Well, it's most of those are inspired by. I mean, to find bad people is not very difficult, you know. Just read the paper this morning, you know, and there's plenty of archetypes. And no, I don't. That's not an issue. And I was brought up in kind of a conservative Lutheran home, so I have no trouble with the concept of sin and evil, even though I don't believe in any of that now. But the idea of having bad people out there, people whose acts may be inexplicable, but
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The result, the outcome is horrible for somebody else. I mean, we've got plenty of people like that, and the bad people in my fiction. I've written about real murders too in my nonfiction, but the bad people in my fiction tend to be people who they're bad because they're liars, among other things. They're liars and they're cheaters, and then I have a couple of legitimate creeps who are, you know, who are sexual predators. And, you know, are just the kind of people you don't want your daughter to ever encounter, you know, that sort of thing. They just appear. I never search for anybody. The research I do tends to be physical research. You know, what was on the corner back in 1955 there? Where was the airport then? And, you know, that sort of thing. It's never about the people. The people are the good people and the bad people and the people in between, which is most of us. We're pretty much the same. And if this book had been set in 1855 instead of 1955, I would probably tell you the same thing. It's the setting that changes, not the people, not the character.
1955. Like what was it you wanted to get or present in a story that included it to be in 1955?
Well, I wanted my childhood. I wanted Minnie. I was 10 years old in 1955. Yeah, do the math. You've got the numbers here.
So you're 45.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you. I was intrigued by what I was reading in the paper then, and I was intrigued by the way. By cars, for instance. I was never a real gearhead, but I sure was fascinated by cars, and those were most of my contemporaries back in those days, because every year there would be a new model, and it was just a tremendous excitement when the new model Chevrolet would hit the streets. And so I find that period very interesting. On the one hand, it seems certainly in retrospect to be a time of kind of innocence. Now that's
Oh, my.
Too, because there was nothing innocent about it, as we all know. But we kind of tell ourselves that. And yet somewhere in my bones, even as a kid, I was aware of something frightening and something really distressing beneath all the pleasantness. And Minneapolis is a very pleasant place, at least it has been until recently. It's very pretty, and the long winters notwithstanding, it's just been a great place to live and grow up and raise kids and so forth. But always been this sense of, again, I don't use the word evil, but this sense of darkness, of threat, that I was aware of even as a little kid going downtown with my big brother to watch a basketball game and at night, and then coming out of the arena and seeing all the neon and all the bright lights and all the people on the streets who, you know, were kind of reflecting all kinds of different things going on. You know, there was some threatening looking people, and to me, that just that era of the 50s just offers, still does, tremendous dramatic possibilities. My imagination is just, it's just like getting a shot, you know. I mean, I'm just, it just pumps me up when I think about that period. And in the late 40s, too, any time between, say, the end of World War II and in the early 60s, when I was kind of wising up a little bit, because I was innocent then and yet had this creeping sense of darkness and evil and just kind of strangeness that still intrigues me.
Well, I was wondering in the beginning of the book, some of the language is maybe a little bit non-PC, which totally works in context to the time. And yeah. it's excellent. And I was just wondering, publishers seem a little bit skittish today? Did you have trouble with publishers wanting to take on the book because of that? Or
it's okay. Not that I know of. I mean, you know, you don't. If somebody turns you down, you're not really. You don't always get an explanation for why it was turned down. I sent out some queries about this book to various publishers, but then I sent the completed manuscript to 7th Street Books in New York, which specializes in crime fiction, and they just bought it without question. They like, and they have since bought my second one, that will come out next year, I believe.
That's great.
And no, there isn't that. I don't. I mean, this book is full of. Somebody asked me what my family thinks of of my fiction, and you know, I've got my wife and kids. They love it, but of course they have to say that, right? my siblings and cousins and nephews and nieces, of which I have thousands. Many of them are very devout religious people, and they're just, if they read it at all, they're just going to be outraged. And but you know, that's the way it is. I write books. I write the kind of books I like to read, and two of my more than that, my writing heroes include Elmore Leonard and George V. Higgins, who in my mind have written the greatest crime fiction ever. And absolutely. You know, their language is pretty rough too, and mm-hmm. I don't know if they're as sexual as I am, as graphic, but I find sex just extremely interesting. And again, maybe that has something to do with my conservative background. But I like to read about sex, and I like to write about sex, and I think it is underwritten about, or it's not written about very well. There's some great prose describing, in the most graphic terms, violence of all sorts, you know, combat stories and homicide stories and so forth. But it's people have trouble writing about sex, and it is difficult to write about. But I think it's, you know, why would you ignore that? Why would you think that that's any less important for most of us than violence? Most of us deal with sex far more often than we deal with any violence. Thank God.
True.
You know?
Well, I think there's a lot of people that are scared of it. A lot of people think of it as something bad.
Sex, like any other human endeavor, is used for good or ill. And certainly in my books, sex is not always, the man and the wife here, you know, and under the laws of God. It, you know, these are adulterers, and these are creepy people who, in whose hands sex is either a shameful thing or downright criminal.
Well, it's interesting. Do you find that you've written true crime and so nonfiction, and now you're writing crime fiction? Do you have a particular thing you want people to get out of your book when they read it, and is it different than your true crime?
That's another good question, and it's a good question because it's almost impossible to answer. I want people to enjoy my books, and enjoy is a funny word when you're writing about the subjects that I'm, you know, but I want them to sit down with a book and say, wow, this is a hell of a story. This guy can tell an interesting story. That's what I want out of them. I want them to say, boy, that's worth the 19 bucks I'm paying for this. Or, you know, they don't have to enjoy it in the sense that you enjoy, you know, some of the less graphic. They would just find it, you know, an interesting way to spend a few hours. That's what I'm looking for. And that's true with both fiction and nonfiction. You know, it's the same thing. You know, the nonfiction I've written generally has been about stuff that has been well covered in the papers and on television. I mean, these are very high profile crime cases that I've written about. In some cases, internationally known. I'm not really educating anybody, and I have no interest in educating anybody. If I wanted to be an educator, I would have taught for a living, and that's the last thing I want to do. But I want to entertain people. I want to tell a good story. That's all I want.
Well, and it's interesting. I think, plus, when you write in the 50s, I think we kind of depend, and we know how people act and react. We know how they behaved. We knew the mannerisms and what we could rely on. I don't know if you can do that so much today, but maybe I'm off, but I don't know that you could.
You mean in terms of the material, or in how we write about it, or what are you speaking
more the
of?
Material? Like I think there's a lot of things that we've learned about, let's say, policing and about the justice system, and we see it. We're inundated. We have way overload of information, and to try and figure out how people act and react, there's no unity in the way we police anymore.
Right. Yeah,
Well,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, back in the 50s, I think it was a much. They told the line that everybody was in sync, sort of, whether it's right or wrong, but they all sort of did things the way they did it.
Well, yes, police tended to be heroes, at least in the white community, and I'm not sure. You know, I wrote a book about the assassination of a white police officer in St. Paul in 1970 that that resulted in a 35-year-long investigation and finally the conviction of a couple of black guys. And it was a very disturbing story to research because I was learning things about the way black community here in the Twin Cities, which has always been relatively small, what was perceived and was treated by the white, mainly white police. And it was just, it was really disheartening. And because you want to think better of your city, you want to think better of the authorities. I mean, I grew up thinking that you respect the law and that you respect police officers and firefighters and those people who are operating for our welfare and then, you know, one of the hard things about growing up is learning that it's not always as clear cut as you think it is. And so my cops, my fictional cops, are also influenced by World War II. A lot of them had served in the war, in combat. My lead detective here, Arnie Anderson, was an infantryman in Europe and was part of the rescue of Bastogne during the Battle of the Bulge. And you can see, I hope, why he is the way he is today because of that combat experience 10 years earlier. And so that's a big influence on my cops. My cops are rough guys. They don't mind whacking somebody, knocking them upside the head, just kind of, as one cop said, just on general principle. You know, this guy is kind of a low life. They haven't accused him of any crime, but he just kind of pissed them off the way his attitude. And so when they're leaving, one of them just smacks the guy in the face and knocks him over and bloodies his nose. And nobody thinks twice about it. That cops got away with that a lot back in the day and were rarely challenged. Once in a while, someone would raise a stink about it and maybe the cop would be suspended for a couple of months. But to my knowledge, there were very little cases I can think of none here, where a police officer was actually brought up on charges and convicted of a crime.
Did you find it difficult writing about a lot of these crimes and the way police deal with crimes nowadays? Are following it now because you've seen so many changes over the years, mm-hmm. right? You've seen it go from back then till now.
Yeah.
And is it harder for you to write something nowadays than it was?
I don't think so. And you know, remember, I'm not writing much about current activities, current crimes. And I have some of that. Maybe that's one of the reasons I kind of hark back to the 50s, because it's not necessarily easier, but it's maybe a little bit more black and white, pardon the expression, and therefore easier to dramatize. I guess that's the way to put it.
So now your book, The Secret Lives of Dentists, what made you choose that title? What made you kind of do this?
Well, story? Because my inspiration was not only the case I had mentioned that I grew up reading about in the Minneapolis Tribune. There was also a very interesting long-form magazine article in Harper's Magazine in 1982 by a fine writer named David Owen. And it was called The Secret Lives of Dentists. And it was one of the most interesting magazine stories I had ever read up to that point, and I cut it out and I saved it, and it told about these you know, the private lives of Dennis and how you live with the fact that everybody in the world hates you. nobody likes a dentist. At least they didn't back in those days. Now they've got all these techniques now where you go to the dentist and it's probably a woman, and you know, you've got music and you've got, you know, it's not scary anymore. Well, when I was a kid in the 50s, it was scary as hell, and kids would go to great lengths to avoid dentists. And this story by David Owen, the suggestion was, how would you feel about life if you realized that everybody hated you? You know, you spend your life with your fingers in somebody else's mouth, and nobody wants to go see you. So that stuck with me, and I thought, you know, I haven't read any fiction about, you know, where a dentist has been the protagonist, or at least one of the main characters. I know there was a movie out about 20 years ago called The Secret Lives of Dennis, and I'm sure it was awful, just having seen the trailer, but I never saw the whole thing. You know, it's one of those dumbass rom-com or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And I love the title, though, because, and I thought, you know, I told my wife, well, if nothing else, every Dennis wife in the country is going to buy this book. You know, she know what those secrets are. So anyway, I'm being silly here, but that's, I just was kind of intrigued by that title that I stole from David Owen. And I thought it worked well with the difficulties that a Jewish dentist would have in a town that not too much earlier had been considered the anti-Semitic, capital of the United States. So, that combination, you know, what the difficulty of a Jewish dentist being accused and tried for the murder of a young white woman, a young Gentile woman, that could really add to the drama of this.
But yeah, you just need it to make him gay.
Yeah, right. Well, see. You know, that's a good point, and that's something that probably wouldn't have worked very well in the 50s, when you know, right, people were just, you didn't know they were gay, or maybe you suspected, and of course you didn't even use the word gay. There's a couple of references in my books, and you talk about, you know, being non-PC to queers and fags and stuff, because that's the way they talked in those days. You know, that was the language, and you know, as loathsome as,
oh my,
and some of the ethnic references, that was just part of the dialogue in those days. So that's in the book too, and there is one reference to homosexual sex, but very brief. The two apparent homosexuals at that point are just very minor characters, and the major involvement were people who were engaged in heterosexual activities, if they were involved in sex at all.
So do you have a website or a place that you'd like people to come and find you and find out about your books?
Yes. Nice of you to offer that. It is... It is W.A. Winter Books, all one word, no punctuation, wawinterbooks.com. And that'll take you to my website, and that'll have all my books, fiction and nonfiction. Not like there are that many, but
great. Well, we'll have that up on our website as well, and we don't worry about the punctuation because most of our readers can't.
Are we off the air here, well, Alan?
It's been a real no. That's how I do. But it's been a real pleasure, and I'm glad you came on the show. The book is called "The Secret Lives of Dentists." Like, we have enough to be scared of already, but now you've got a horrifying book here. No, and our guest is W.A. Winter. So I want to thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me. That's great questions, and I enjoyed our conversation very much.
find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.